Hi, everyone. This is Martin Willis with Podcast UFO. We have a great episode for you today. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/podcastUFO. You can listen to us on your smartphone on Stitcher. We have a free app on our website, which is podcastufo.com. And we encourage you to interact with our guests. You just go to our website. On the top menu bar, you'll see Interact. Once again, we have the great and the one only Stanton T. Friedman for part two. And in this episode, we talk about Majestic 12 documents. We talk about Bob Lazar, skeptics, and more. It's a great show, and I hope you enjoy it. All right, we're back for part two with the great Stanton T. Friedman. How you doing, Stan?
Well, I'm still alive and kicking. What the heck?
Yeah. Thanks again for joining us. So, Stan, I understand how the Majestic 12 documents were received by that Hollywood producer and all that. And I know you were doing some real intense research to make sure that this wasn't a hoax. Can you give us an update on what's going on with them?
Well, first I want to make clear that there are well over 100 Majestic 12, MJ-12 documents. I am standing behind three. The Eisenhower briefing document, which lists the members of the group, gives some background. The Truman Forrestal memo, which supposedly established the group in September 1947. And the Cutler-Twining memo, which was found at the National Archives after Bill Moore and Jamie Chandray, I'd been working closely with them, had received some crazy postcards, but which talked about things in Washington that clearly seemed to say you ought to go to Washington. I had discovered that a certain record group at the National Archives had finally been classification reviewed, and it covered Air Force intelligence files from like 48 to 57, I think it was. So Bill and Jamie trotted off to Washington, and going through a whole bunch of, one of the groups had been declassified or classification reviewed. And in this, they found a document, the so-called Cutler-Twining memo. And so that became the third of the ones that I say are genuine. Then there's a whole slew of nonsense out there. Anyway, the attacks continue. None of them any smarter than the first attacks. And you get some idea of the level of sophistication of the attacks when Philip J. Klass, who was the senior avionics editor for Aviation Week and Space Technology in Washington, and was the go-to guy for any media guy because he was right there, and who said there's nothing to flying saucers, fine writer, he wrote actually four books about UFOs, all saying it's all nonsense. I debated him on Nightline, as a matter of fact, and at Trinity University in Texas. That's another story. Anyway, to give you some idea of the level of discourse, Phil said, well, obviously that Cutler-Twining memo is phony because it's done in the large Pica type, but I have nine documents here from the National Security Council, which is mentioned in this thing. It's a brief document. They were all done in elite type. So I challenge you to find any other genuine documents in a holistic criteria done in the same size and style type. And I will give you $100 each, up to a maximum of 10, unfortunately, for all of these. Now, he had never been to the Eisenhower Library. I've spent weeks there, literally. I went to my drawer, file drawer here, and pulled out 20 Pica-type documents. They didn't all meet his criteria, though, unfortunately. Had to be signed, had to, you know, all kinds of junk. Okay, so I knew I was going to the Eisenhower Library anyway, and I went. And I found 14 FICA-type documents and copied them and sent him copies and an invoice for $1,000 because he'd only paid for $100. And he had told everybody about challenging me. Bill Morgan, three different people asking, hey, what about this challenge to Stan, et cetera. He didn't tell anybody about paying me. He sent me a check for $1,000. And he got very angry when I included a copy of his check in Flying Saucers and Science, threatened to sue me. And I finally said, Bill, look, you sent me a check. I Xeroxed it. I took the check to the bank. They cashed it. I can do whatever I darn please with the Xerox. I was a nice guy. I blacked out the banking information on the bottom. You know. But, I mean, that's typical of the level of discourse. I got another guy who says, oh, the date format's wrong on the date. It says 18 November, comma, 1952. That comma violates the government style rules. They have to remember this is long before computers were the way of doing things. Mm. If you go to the archives, you find all kinds of date formats. I found the same date format used by two of the members of MJ-12. Kevin Randall, who has viciously attacked the documents right from the word go, even wrote a whole book, about which I wrote a long, detailed rebuttal. Said, well, in his book, he doesn't say it anymore, but the strongest objection is that the briefing officer in the Eisenhower briefing document is listed as Admiral Roscoe Hellencoder. Hmm. But he was only a vice admiral. Obviously, the document's a fraud. Well, it turns out that it's with standard practice to use generic ranks. Ike used them, as a matter of fact.
Not like rear admiral or anything like that. Just
that's right. Admiral. And, yeah, and you can answer the phone Colonel Jones. You better sign a report, Lieutenant Colonel Jones, if you are one. Mm-hmm. And I went to the Eisenhower Library again, and when Brigadier General Goodpaster was Ike's staff secretary, he'd been with him for a long time, he would keep notes at meetings that they had, all kinds of people, and it was clear for everything. And when he wrote up the memcons, as they were called, memos of conversation, he would list at the front part, all the people who were at the meeting, always using only generic ranks, called himself General Goodpaster, signed it Brigadier General Goodpaster. And I asked two different archivists independently so they wouldn't, you know, get together, does this bother you, this use of generic ranks? Standard practice. Now, one of the kickers is the Navy has three flag ranks, the Army has four. You know, how do you say who gets the better parking place kind of thing. But that, Kevin said, that was the strongest argument against them. He doesn't say that anymore. Mm. There are all kinds of objections that are really strange. So I've dealt with them in Top Secret Magic, second edition especially, 2005. I have a long piece on my website, www.dantonfriedman.com, a four-parter about the arguments against, and I even at one point had a list of, I forget, three dozen items that we didn't know to be true before we got the documents, but that did turn out to be true. So how did a hoaxer know? Well, for example, it says that General Twining began the investigation on July 7th. Now, We had no way of knowing whether that was true or not, but then I talked to his daughter, and she told me the name of his pilot who lived in the Washington, D.C. area, and I found the pilot, and he brought his log book. Twining was still flying, but they had a pilot who did most of the flying. There was flight pay and stuff like that. And then later on, I found Twining's flight log had been in a box that had been classified until I was trying to get all of that declassified. You can only ask for a few boxes at a time. So I got Twining's actual flight log. And indeed, went to New Mexico on July the 7th. Hmm. How did anybody get that right?
Right.
The day of the Truman Forrestal memo, it mentions Vannevar Bush, who was head of the Office of Scientific Research and Development during the war and was there for the first atomic bomb and all kinds of stuff. It turned out that date was the only date in a several-month period when Truman, Forrestal, and Bush were all together. I asked the library, did you ever tell anybody else that? No, nobody else ever asked. So there's a whole long list of these. Well, one of the most startling ones shocked me, certainly. One of the people listed was Dr. Donald H. Menzel. He was a professor of astronomy at Harvard University. Now, he stands out like a sore thumb because everybody else we know from the jobs they held had a very high-level security clearance. General Twining, General Vandenberg, Admiral Hillenkoetter, Admiral Sowers, right on down the line. But you don't need a high-level security clearance to teach astronomy at Harvard. And beyond that, Menzel had written three anti-UFO books. How could he be part of a team that knew about recovered bodies and wreckage and all this kind of stuff? I was very dubious. I'd had one run-in with him on the phone. I called to invite him to attend a lecture I was giving at Harvard because I wasn't sure whether they'd made public notice of it. It was an engineering alumni group. And I called, and he answers, and I said, Dr. Menzel, my name is Stanton Friedman. Oh, I know all about you. Oh, you saw my congressional testimony next to yours? You can't be a scientist and believe in flying saucers, he said. I laughed. That didn't make him happy.
Yeah.
So he ranted for a couple minutes. I said, look, Dr. Menzel, I called out of courtesy to invite you to my program. Well, of course I won't go. So I told the story that night so they know I wasn't afraid of them. I was not a fan of Donald Menzel. Well, I found an item at the National, at the Library of Congress Manuscript Division in the Van Bush papers. And here was this letter from a law firm in Boston thanking Dr. Bush for his defense of Dr. Menzel at these loyalty hearings, which I'd never heard about, and telling him that he'd been cleared and everything. So I followed up on that and talked to the law firm and found out the record, 1,000 pages, was over at the archives at Harvard where Menzel's papers were. Now, all these guys were dead, see? Mm-hmm. So I called. I had to get permission from three different people to look at his papers. I got a grant from the Fund for UFO Research to go up down to Boston, spend a few days. Had to get his wife's permission to look at his unpublished autobiography, and was totally shocked by what I found. Because when I first heard his name was on the list, I figured, you know, somebody's just trying to show that, you know, these guys will believe anything kind of thing. Mm. Well, it turns out I had looked at his papers at the American Philosophical Society Library in Philadelphia, and I talked to the University of Denver. He had gone there as an undergrad where some of his papers were. But at the archives, wow. I didn't find anything that said UFOs, but I did find a file that said JFK. And I'm wondering, that's intriguing. Why is, what's the connection between Menzel and JFK? Well, it turns out JFK, John F. Kennedy, was on the board of overseers at Harvard, and his area of interest was astronomy, so we worked with Menzel on that, and his wife told me later that he was a great admirer of Kennedy. In letters to JFK, we have Menzel saying, there is an area where I might be able to be of some assistance to you. I've had a long or continuous association with the National Security Agency. More than 30 years, and its Navy predecessor of anybody. When we are properly cleared to each other, I can tell you more. That's for a pregnant phrase. So I did a lot more digging. I mean, that really got me turned on, and found out that he had a top-secret Umbra clearance with the CIA and did all kinds of classified work for 30 companies. It turns out he was a cryptographer during the war, taught cryptography, a world-class expert, had learned Japanese to help in the crypto work, and he had this long history of highly classified work for the government that nobody knew about.
Wow.
As a matter of fact, Sky and Telescope devoted two issues to him, one when he died and one at the 100th anniversary of his birth. Not one word about his highly classified activities after the war. And as a matter of fact, he was head of communications unit number one of the Naval Reserve in Cambridge. So that was a real shocker. I mean, and half the people in ufology said, oh, Stan, he couldn't have led a double life. I said, why not? Every spy does. Look at Burgess, Philby, and McLean. These were Russian spies working for MI5 in England. you know. And you've got to be really careful when you're working in one intelligence agency and passing stuff to the others, because if you're not careful, something may get out that somebody will know the only place they could have gotten it was somebody on the inside.
And right, yeah.
So that I then went down to the Forrestal Library, I mean the Firestone Library, Forrestal papers and stuff. I did one heck of a lot of digging, and it was tedious, sure, but you got to dot the I's and cross the T's.
Mm-hmm.
And I, in my book, Top Secret Magic, I bring up every argument I could find against the documents and showed what was wrong with the argument. And, you know, Kevin Randall on occasion said, well, it doesn't talk about this, so therefore it must be phony. Like he was psychic and knows what it should be talked about. Yeah. And as it says, it's a preliminary briefing, the Eisenhower briefing document. And, you know, it was kind of intriguing. Two Air Force, two Army, two Navy, five scientists, and Secretary of Defense Forrestal. And it's been fascinating. And I've yet to hear an argument that stands up against those three documents.
Mm-hmm.
I showed, in the book, I showed why a whole bunch of others are phony documents. As a matter of fact, I call a number of them emulations. I found original items that have been published in books that somebody had retyped and used word for word, except for changing a date maybe and a
really?
Sentence over here and over there. And I call them emulations.
Mm-hmm.
And once you read the two side by side, you say, well, obviously this guy copied this thing. But it took a lot of work. Now, fortunately, I'm lucky I live a mile and a half from the University of New Brunswick Library, which is a big library. Well, to give me an example, one of the people mentioned in one of these documents is General Wiedemeyer. Now, I'd heard of him, roughly, so I'm asking a guy at the Marshall Archives. Archivists are very helpful people. I've been to the Marshall Archives, so he had a face. You know, I didn't just let him do all the work, in other words. I said, can you think of any reason why General Wiedemeyer should have been connected with this high-technology MJ-12 group? He said, not a one, Stan. Why don't you look at his book? Oh, didn't know he'd written a book. Yeah, the Wiedemeyer Report. So I go over to the library. Like I say, a mile and a half. They had it. I called first. They had it. Grabbed it. And in 10 minutes of glancing through it, there were three letters that had been emulated.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. Changed. They had, the way they published these, they reset the type, but they included the handwritten parts. They Xeroxed them, I guess you could say. And so when you find that the placement is identical with the document that I call an emulation, it'll have a date, and I agree, and Harry Truman, the same places on the page.
Mm-hmm.
That's an emulation. And when you find tricky things, like on one of them, Wiedemeyer, it says, when you're finished in China, Wiedemeyer was a China expert. He'd spent a lot of time in China. General Marshall had sent him to China. He spent almost a year there. And it said, when you're finished at Sandia, go to New Mexico. In the original, it says, when you, this is to General Twining, supposedly, in the Wiedemeyer letter, when you are finished in China, go to Korea, which is not in China.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, typical of the kind of things, you pay attention and you say, uh-oh, bingo, that's not true. And so I had to go through all kinds of junk because the trivia, well, if that were, you know, real, it would have said this or that or something else. And
mm-hmm.
so it was, you know, solving. I like doing crossword puzzles.
Yeah. Sounds like a big one.
Well, it is, but it to me, now I worked under security for 14 years. I've been to 20 archives. You know, I'm accustomed to dealing with documents, wrote classified documents myself, et cetera. And so there was a strong push on my part to get to the truth about these
mm-hmm.
things. I was just as happy to prove that certain documents were frauds. And, well, here's a typical objection. One guy wrote a long thing. Friedman knows this. Every top secret document has to have a top secret control word on it. And at that record group at the National Archives, every single document is top secret, and they all have control numbers on it. Well, I had the finder's guide for that, 57 pages long, for that file at the National Archives. And it is not true. Only about 3% of the documents were top secret. And I got two different archivists to go on record, because I'd already published two top secret documents that didn't have control numbers on them, so I knew that it happened. Mm-hmm. Two of them who said, the guy at the Marshall Archive said, Stan, if they had any top secret control numbers, we'd still be fighting World War II. And the guy at the Eisenhower said, we have many top secret documents that do not have control numbers. And in case people are wondering, why not? Well, it's very straightforward. If General Jones sends a one-page memo to General Williams, he doesn't want to go through all the problem of getting control number and a lot of paperwork. So he puts it in the top secret bag, and it goes to him at the Pentagon, and no sweat. On the other hand, if you have a 20-page report that's going to 20 different people, you have to have a top secret control number because you need to inventory all of these things.
Yeah, it makes sense. So,
but here were guys saying this was the best argument, and so I have to check all this stuff out. It's tedious, but there's a great aha feeling, I must admit, when you find something. So I'm convinced that there are three genuine Majestic 12 documents. All the rest is window dressing and probably phony to muddy the waters. All those documents are all phony. It's easy to say that,
Yeah.
And I'm still waiting for anybody to come up with a good argument. I'm happy to debate anybody who's listening or who isn't listening. I'll take Kevin Randall on anytime. I will say this. I am not psychic. So I don't know why. One of his arguments was, Friedman thinks that there was a crash in the plains of San Augustine at the same time as Roswell, but it isn't mentioned in this document. So if it isn't mentioned, either that didn't happen or the documents are phony. And I point out that I'm not psychic. It says it's a preliminary briefing to be followed by a complete one. This was on 18 November 1952 when Ike got briefed at the Pentagon, right date, on a whole bunch of different areas. What people forget was that Ike had been in Europe for a good solid year and a half or more before he ran for president in 52. He'd been an impossible job. How do you get Germany, England, France, the United States, and Britain to work together to defend against the Russians? They just fought the second of two world wars. They were killing each other. Now, only somebody like Ike could manage that. You know, he had his hands full, is what I'm saying. And so he needed to find out what was the latest thing going on here. And what it says in the Truman Forrestal memo is that the Majestic 12 would be accountable only to the president. So they weren't sending copies all around the place to somebody who might be interested. That's not how you do these things. And so, it's been fun to run down the list of false arguments, totally wrong arguments. It's a pain in the neck, to tell you the truth. But you have to do it. If I'm going to stand up in public,
that's right,
then I have to do that, like it or not.
Well, that's what I appreciate about your credibility in doing that. So, Stan, I read your blog about Bob Lazar, and I saw a clip online as well, and that you are calling him out as a fraud. And what upsets me the most about things like this is I think he's taken the whole UFO credibility and taken it a step backwards. He still fools so many people, and he had me. I was totally convinced when I watched some films that he was in. And he's fooled all kinds of people making films. He fooled someone that was a pilot that was a very well-known pilot. He's had a lot of people on his side. It's all bunk. And can you make a comment on that?
Well, okay. Let's go back many years ago. I first heard about him when I was visiting Las Vegas from George Knapp and John Lear. And, you know, when somebody's calling himself a nuclear physicist, which he was, and because I'm known to be a nuclear physicist, a lot older than Bob, I might add, everybody started asking me about. So I decided before I express an opinion, I better get some facts and some data. So I wrote the stuff, talked to various people about them. I saw that there were some misconceptions. For example, George Knapp was one of the finest UFO-related journalists. I mean, somebody who really knows the subject, had presumed wrongly, for example, that if Bob worked at Los Alamos, he must be a scientist. And that he would have all kinds of high-level security clearance. He certainly need a clearance to work there. If he was sweeping the floor, he would need one. But certainly there are plenty of people in Los Alamos who aren't scientists and who do have clearances. Anyway, I started doing some checking, and especially after I read some of his notions about element 115 or 118 at one time, it varied. And so I started doing some checking. And I did have one phone conversation with Bob, and I had a call from Gene Hoth, Bob's buddy, who was saying, what would it take to convince you that Bob was legit? And so I told him, I said, well, you know, scientists belong to professional associations. They have resumes. They have diplomas, published papers. You know, these are the kind of things you need. He said, okay. So I sent Gene copies of my diplomas from the University of Chicago, listings in big fat books of people who were alumni of the University of Chicago and members of the American Nuclear Society membership directory and the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronauts, and a resume. I hadn't used it for a while, 8 pages long, listing a bunch of papers and all that sort of stuff. And, of course, I never heard back from Bob. Then I decided, well, we'll really go into this. I checked MIT. I'm in the habit of checking on people, and not just Bob, because I've found that integrity is kind of a dead word these days. Some people think everybody lies. I've been told that a couple of times. So, you know, I didn't grow up that way. That's not what I believe. Hmm. And so I checked. Well, to give you an example, I say that it's common and needs to be done, checking. Somebody told me he would have been a graduate of the Air Force Academy. And in talking to him, it just didn't strike me as appropriate. So I called the registrar's office and gave her his name. They can tell you whether somebody graduated there. They may not give you a grade point average and stuff like that, but you're entitled to that. Okay, he hadn't graduated from there. So I asked her, I said, you get a lot of calls about people who claim to have gone there and all the time, which was kind of brought me up short a little bit. She said the saddest story was a woman called and said her fiancé had lost his diploma, and she thought it would be great if she could get a replacement. Can I do that?
Oh, no.
Yes. You see where this one's going. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with getting a replacement diploma. Well, it turned out the guy hadn't gone there.
Yeah.
So I checked at MIT. I checked, I mean, the claim was he'd got a master's in MIT in nuclear physics, another master's in Caltech in electronics. Now, that in itself doesn't make a lot of sense, because if you already got a master's, Caltech won't do you for a master's program, generally speaking. Anyway, Caltech had never heard of him. MIT, I talked to the registrar. They'd never heard of him. I talked to the physics department. They'd never heard of him. I talked to the guy who collects commencement directories. I mean, every year they put out a list. And he had never heard of him. I talked to the legal counsel. I said, is it possible? I mean, the story was that his record had been wiped out by the government, erased by the government. And that seems strange for several reasons. One is that MIT's been doing people at MIT have been doing classified work since World War II. Hmm. There are no strangers to classified work. And there's a very big difference between saying somebody went there and telling you what he did and the technical work he had done or the classified publication or anything like that. It's not the same thing. So anyway, the legal counsel said there is no way to wipe your record clean. Now, somebody else had already checked all the yearbooks. for when he was supposedly there and not found any record of him. So then a few more things that came up. When I talked to Los Alamos, I called them, and I gave them two names, Bob's name and a guy that I had worked with on radiation shielding for a nuclear rocket propulsion system. So I knew he'd been there. So to make sure I was in an office that would tell me about people who were employed there, gave them the two names. They had my guy, and I knew we had a top-secret clearance from the work that we were doing. No listing for Bob. I call people who have they put out a phone directory. And, yes, everybody who's at the lab has a phone. But if you'll notice at the bottom of the page, or at the top of the page, actually, it says for employees of Los Alamos National Laboratory, of the Department of Energy, and it named several more consulting outfits, one of which was Kirk Meyer. You go to Bob's name in the phone book, and after his name, it says K/M, Kirk Meyer. So he worked for a subcontractor, not for the lab. And all the subcontractors have to be listed in the thing, too. So that he raises all kinds of questions. And then I found that the phone number that was in there was for the, it's a long name, Clinton D. Anderson Maison something or other accelerator facility. It's a place where professors from around the country come if they've got certain far-out physics questions where you need a Maison accelerator. Their system is unique in the world, actually. And so what happens is the professors can't bring all their grad students with them, so they need technicians to help them out in setting up their experiments. And apparently that's what Bob was a technician. And I've never said he was stupid. He is stupid. So, okay, then there was the little son at the little alien in Mitchell, Nevada. Bob was to speak there, but he didn't give a talk. He answered questions, and somebody sent me a tape. One of the questions was, can you name any of your past professors? Because I had raised that objection. Chicago's prestigious, where I went to school, and I can tell you the names of my professors. Bob's a lot younger, you remember, and MIT is equally prestigious. And they asked, and Bob said, well, let's see now. Bill Duxler, he'll remember me from Caltech Physics. Well, I'm glad he didn't say John Smith, because he'd been hard to find. So I went directory of the American Physical Society, which, of course, I had as a member, and there's a William Duxler listed, and I called him. Did have a PhD, did teach physics, but at Pierce Junior College, not at Caltech. Now, it's not there physically in Southern California. Intellectually, it's a very long way. Now, Duxler was a little upset that somebody was using his name. He checked and found out that, indeed, Bob had taken a course from him the same year, supposedly at MIT, 2,500 miles away. That's a pretty good-sized commute, and quite frankly, if you can go to MIT, you don't go to Pierce Junior College. If it happens, I've lectured at Pierce Junior College many years ago. And incidentally, I guess this led to the next test that I did. I was a little irked. I'd been accepted at MIT out of high school. I was valedictorian in my high school class, but I couldn't afford to go. Three of my buddies had been accepted. They could afford to go. I mean, the tuition was $900 a year. Now it's 20-some thousand, but that was a very long time ago. I'm an old guy. And so I was a little peeved, though. So George Knapp gave me the information about where Bob went to high school. So I called his high school. Well, you'll have to call me back so I can dig out his records. Okay, I did that a couple hours later. And I said, I'm having trouble because I'm getting different reports from different places that, you know, I don't know how legitimate he is. Well, let's see now here. He graduated in August, not with his class. That was the first thing she said. That already raises big question marks, because normally that means you flunked a course. I said, well, he did take a lot of science courses, didn't he? Chemistry. I'm waiting and waiting. I said, what else? Chemistry. Starting to laugh a little bit. Well, I know myself you had to have more than a chemistry course to get into MIT as a high school student. I know that. I said, well, and then I did something. I'm not proud of it, but maybe it did some good. I said, he was valedictorian, wasn't he? No, he didn't say he was.
He said he was.
Uh-huh. But, and she laughed and said, no, it wasn't. Well, was he in the top 10? No, more laughter. Top 20, top 50, top 100. And finally, she's laughing so much, she says he was like 261 out of 363, something like that. That's the bottom third when you figure it out. Hmm. Well, I also checked admissions department at MIT. You can't get in unless you're in the top 10 or 20% of your class. It's a very prestigious place, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's all hard to compare all the high schools around the country. So they have a little leeway with college prep scores and stuff like that. But so I knew that he was lying then.
Yeah.
And incidentally, I reported that to George Knapp. And I said, you know, why not get a copy of his high school transcript? He can get that. And so he talked to Bob and supposedly prepared a letter for Bob to sign requesting a copy of his transcript. Somehow he never got one.
Yeah.
Now, also, I checked. So, you know, I'm running on empty here. But I also checked on his Element 115 scheme. Mm-hmm. Did a little looking around, and I had several people write me when somebody ran a big accelerator for weeks and discovered four atoms of element 115. Mm. Oh, doesn't that prove Bob was telling the truth? No, it doesn't. You need 10 to the 23rd atoms, not four. Mm. You know, 10 followed by 23 zeros atoms. In addition, all the isotopes were short half-life. Now, if your half-life is under a minute, there is no way you can accumulate the 500 pounds that Bob had said Los Alamos had accumulated and that he had stole some. Now, that would be, if it existed, would be extraordinarily valuable. It would be like saying, oh, I stole a bunch of plutonium U-239 bomb grade. It ain't easy to do. Believe me, the safeguards. I worked in the nuclear business for 14 years. Mm-hmm. The safeguards are awful strict. To get out the door with something that's radioactive, you know?
That's right. My brother works. My brother-in-law works there now, Los Alamos.
And
he's just getting ready to retire.
What it all boils down to is Bob isn't telling the truth about Bob. Oh, there is a document from the Department of Naval Intelligence, when really it's Office of Naval Intelligence, and it's got an amount to supposedly a W-2 slip, which, you know, it's a couple weeks' pay, and you don't get a specialized security clearance in a couple of weeks. So it's downhill from there is what I'm saying. We got nothing. Bupkis, as somebody once said to me.
Well, you know, and it's really something because he is very good. I mean, he you can tell he's smart, and he's very good at what he's doing.
Yes, he is.
Very convincing.
I was told by a radio guy from Berkeley, they interviewed him and he brought with him, the radio guy, a scientist from Stanford, but he didn't say that's what he was. And occasionally he would throw in physics questions, and Bob could answer none of them. And the guy told the radio guy, he says, how much you want to bet he doesn't show up tomorrow to do a second segment? He didn't. He didn't.
Yeah.
So, I'm not trying to second-guess why he did all this. Why, you know, there was going to be a movie at one time, the life story of this brilliant young genius who was being harassed by the government, but who broke the biggest story of all time, et cetera. They backed off from doing the movie. I didn't have anything to do with that. But and Bob is clever in other ways. There had been a company called United Nuclear Corporation, and they got taken over by somebody else, so the name was in limbo. So Bob picked it up, and he established a company, United Nuclear, and sells stuff for labs and so forth. He's a bright guy. I'm not saying he's an idiot. I'm saying he's not telling the truth. And don't ask me why. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm a dumb old physicist, you know.
Well, I for one, appreciate that you expose that. And because, you know, just like I say, it just takes everything a step backwards when someone like that does what they do. And I know there's a lot of other people out there doing similar things. I have another question for you. I have a friend that's basically an all-out skeptic. And he and I get into some heavy-duty discussions. And whenever I show him something like, oh, say, Endlesham Forest event, or say the Mexico released tape of UFOs, or something like that, he always finds information online, you know, to debunk whatever it is, no matter how solid it is. And his number one thing that he says to me, with everyone having a cell phone with a camera on it these days, how come there's not more evidence? And
well, you know, a cell phone is not a fine scientific instrument at all by any stretch of imagination. I mean, the moon's pretty big in the sky, but you can cover it with an aspirin at arm's length. It's not going to show up much. You know, absence of evidence is not evidence for absence. And if you have a cell phone picture, you're going to have to go public with it. Many people don't want to go public with any stuff, partly because they're not very good evidence. I'd rather look at the pictures that Dr. Bruce McAbee, an optical physicist, has examined. Mm-hmm. The question isn't, are there phony pictures? Are there a lot of things you'd like to have? Of course. But the fact that you don't have what you'd like doesn't mean the thing isn't real. It's kind of like there are some people who don't believe the government can keep secrets. Dr. Tyson from the Hayden Planetarium. Well, everybody said this at Penn State last year. Everybody knows governments can't keep secret. The proof of that is look how much we know about President Clinton's genitalia. That's really relevant, you know. I've had Seth Shostak said, look, FEMA and Katrina, the government can't do anything right. And, you know, what in the world is the connection there? Mm. You know, he says they run the post office, for goodness sake. Well, I'm interested in the NRO, the CIA, the DIA, the OSI, all those alphabet soup agencies. I've been to 20 archives. I'll guarantee you there's loads of stuff that is still classified. The Eisenhower Library, Ike went out of office in 1961, still had a couple hundred thousand pages of classified material. Look how many years later this is, you know? Hmm. So the notion that they can't keep secrets is absurd, and you can do it very specifically. I can show you loads of top secret Umbra CIA UFO documents, all blacked out except the five or six words. Some of them don't even have five or six words you can read. They say deny in toto.
That's like a joke when you say those.
Well, the NSA released 100, and finally, they them back. They refuse to release them. Sources and methods information. We can't release them. Prohibited by law. No culture, the number of the law. Well, they finally released them because President Clinton signed Executive Order 12958, making it much tougher to keep stuff more than 25 years old. Classified. You really have to justify it. So nobody thought Clinton would be reelected, and they knew the Republicans would veto this or, you know, get rid of it. So nobody did anything, and then he was reelected, and suddenly the Air Force was looking at 100,000 pages a month to try to clear stuff. So the NSA finally released 156 UFO documents, all of them top secret Umbra. Wow! Until you look at them. Hmm. You can read one line, one sentence per page typically, and the rest is whited out. Not blacked out,
wow.
Because Phil Klass had told them that Friedman shows blacked out documents and people laugh and he doesn't tell them sources and methods. Of course I do, but can anybody believe that 97% of what's on a page is sources and methods information and it's only the other 3% that deals with the topic under which it is filed,
right.
Like UFOs?
Yeah.
I mean, that's absurd. So can't cover up? And, you know, we've got the work of, as I mentioned earlier, Carol Bolander saying reports which could affect national security are not part of the Blue Book system. Yet the Air Force has been saying, oh, that covered everything. That's all there was. Project Blue Book. That's it. So, you know, there are people who do their research by proclamation. Sounds like your friend.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, the proper way to do research is investigation. It's like, you know, we're talking about the J-12 documents. Well, you can say, well, that doesn't look right to me. That's not good enough.
That's right.
show me what's wrong with it, you know? Don't tell me, well, you don't think he would have put that way. Mm-hmm. You're not psychic, you know? So I get bothered just because these guys get too much space.
Yes.
I'm perfectly happy to put them in their place if I get the chance.
Yep. Now, I would say that, hang on just a second. Oh, okay, let me just, I'm going to have just go two more questions,
sure.
And I think that we'll be out of time here. Okay, since your interest began so many years ago, do you think we're any closer to knowing the truth about all this as a society?
Well, since I don't know what all the truth is, that's a little harder to say. I think we've gone past the science fiction thing, partly because most people now will tell you the best argument for flying saucers is that we can't be the only ones out there. Look how big the universe is. Look how old it is. Look how many now planets there are. And now people recognize that governments lie. At the end of the Second World War, people trusted the government for good reason. They just won this incredible, terrible battle against the forces of evil.
That's right.
When government said loose lips sink ships, they were telling the truth. They did. But since that time, we found Watergate and so forth, that there are people in authority who, I hate to say this, lie about what they've been doing and what they've done and what they know and what they don't know and so forth. And so I think people are much more cynical about government. Also, since I find 10% of the people in my audience believe they've seen one, that means that an awful lot of people know somebody that they trust who has told them about seeing a UFO. And, you know, the fact that some of the top grossing motion pictures of all time relate to UFOs, mm-hmm. you know, you've got Close Encounters of the Third Kind, you've got E.T., you've got Independence Day, mm-hmm. and there's a whole bunch more sort of off to the side. But that tells you something about people's interest, doesn't it? I think it does. And the fact that I've only had 11 hecklers and over 700 lectures, also interesting. People aren't afraid to heckle if they think you're full of baloney.
That's right, yeah.
You know, right? They go to the delicatessen for that, not for a lecture at a university. So, I think we will learn more. Max Planck, a physicist, once said that new ideas come to be accepted, not because their opponents believe in them, but because their opponents die and a new generation grows up that's accustomed to them. He didn't say understands. He said accustomed to them, you know. So if you look at my book, Science Was Wrong, you'll find that there were people saying space travel was impossible, flight in airplanes was impossible.
That's right.
There are a whole long list of these impossibilities, but finally we had to toss them out because they were wrong. The times they are changing, and I've watched it happen, and I remember talking about space travel when I was a kid. Yeah. And grandmother, I think, saying, hey, he's a bright kid. Why is he talking about space travel? That's nonsense.
Hey, Stan, I got one last question for you today.
Okay.
And first of all, I want to thank you for these two episodes very, very much. I consider you like an icon in this field, and like I said before, with great integrity. Who would you consider is the person or people that are following in your footsteps?
Well, there are other bright, honest people. Dr. Bruce Mackham, for one, an optical physicist.
Yes. Yeah.
John Greenwald, who runs the Black Vault. Now, he's a young guy. John, maybe 31 or so, but he's filed more Freedom of Information Act requests and tabulated more information. Anybody who doesn't think there are any government documents about UFOs, go to the Black Vault. He's one. Kathleen Marden is quite a bit younger than I am. She's done some wonderful work, not only on the Betty and Barney Hill case, but on abductions in general. And honest and careful and scientific, et cetera.
Now, that's Betty's niece still?
Yeah. Uh-huh. She's still Betty's niece.
Yeah,
well, she's really gotten involved, and she's a certified hypnotherapist, and MUFON's investigator training program for 10 years. So she's had a lot of contact with a lot of people, and is really careful and dedicated to truth. I mean, that's what you want most, you know. Those are a few of the people. In terms of journalists, I'd mention George Knapp. We don't always agree on stuff, but he is honest and decent and works hard. Very fine speaker, incidentally, I have to say that. Billy Cox out of Florida has a column, Devoid. And Billy, I got to know him years ago, and he followed up on stuff. He had an explanation for the JAL case. The Phil Klass types had said it was Jupiter and Mars. And so I gave them other information, and obviously they didn't fit when you figure there was a good radar sighting from the ground as well as from the air. Very hard to get Jupiter and Mars from an airplane radar, you know.
That's right.
He learned, and he went and talked to retired General Thomas Jefferson Dubose of Florida. So he followed up. He came to my lectures. So when I see something by these guys, I pay attention, George and Billy. Mm-hmm. So there are good people out there, and I do recommend people join MUFON. I write a regular monthly column, Perceptions. And their big annual, fiesta. It's not a fiesta. It's not even a festival. It's a symposium. We'll be in Cincinnati first week of August. Dennis Balthaser, Roswell, is a good, solid investigator. And because he's in Roswell, of course, that's been one of his areas of specialization, if you will. Mm-hmm. So there are some good people around out there.
Great.
And they deserve our credit.
That's right. That's right. Hopefully I'll have a few of them as guests as we go on. But anyway, Stan, I thank you so much. You've been absolutely wonderful. And again, I'm totally honored that you said yes when I asked you.
Well, it's been my pleasure. I like spreading the word, and I grew up with radio.
Yeah.
You don't need to look fine for radio interviews.
I know. That's why I do it. All right. Take care. So this is Martin Willis
Thanks.
With the great Stanton T. Freeman, and that's it.